This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
The government's got its deal. Those changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax that have been debated for weeks since the budget will get through thanks to a deal with the Greens. So what is this agreement and is anything changing? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to get the rundown from Hack's political reporter. Also ahead, we're going to hear from those whose whole job is dealing with death and making sure that you're ready for it.
If you haven't experienced death, I think that it's like a big question mark, and I think it's something that most young people don't think about or consider.
Yeah, we're finding out what it is like being a death doula and how important this kind of care is for a lot of people. First, though, we're heading to the UK.
Hack.
I mean, I wish him well, but he's got two problems, energy and immigration and crime.
On Triple J.
Look, Australia's no stranger to political turmoil, disruption. We've had our fair share of leaders axed, rolled, forced out in recent years. But spare a thought for the UK. They're about to get their seventh Prime Minister in 10 years. So Keir Starmer announcing his resignation yesterday after months of controversy. And the guy who's set to replace him as the UK's leader, he was only elected to Parliament a few days ago. Alice Angeloni explains.
Guys, the Prime Minister of our country is resigning.
Pop the news on now. Keir Starmer's resigned.
I mean, to be fair, we all knew it was coming, so it's not like a big surprise. And we're not going to miss him.
Thank f*** for that.
Overnight, big news went down in UK politics.
The question my party is asking now is whether I am best placed to lead us into the next general election. I have heard the answer, and I accept that answer with good grace. That is why I will resign as leader of the Labour Party.
It makes him the sixth British Prime Minister to leave office in the past 10 years.
It's hard because we've had a lot of Prime Ministers leave.
But just 2 years ago, Sir Keir Starmer won a landslide general election. So what's changed?
I don't think he's been put in a very easy position, especially with everything that's just like going on in the country and in the world in general.
Well, a series of policy missteps, backflips, and an inability to cut through with messaging saw his popularity within the electorate plummet.
An unemployment crisis arose while he was in power.
As he lost support among his colleagues too.
With the vast majority of his own Labour Party calling for him to step down, he either has to make a really, really big move in order to keep the Labour Party in power, or he will be voted out.
Especially around his controversial appointment of Lord Peter Mandelson as US ambassador, after it was revealed that Starmer was aware Mandelson had links to Jeffrey Epstein.
I should not have appointed Peter Mandelson. I take responsibility for that decision, and I apologise again to the victims of the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein.
And he was sometimes dubbed Never Hear Keir by critics for his focus on foreign affairs.
He had a lot of problems to kind of fix.
Who's going to be in charge now?
Well, just after Sir Keir announced his resignation, former Mayor of Greater Manchester Andy Burnham was sworn in as the new MP for Makerfield.
I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to His Majesty King Charles.
Polls have been clocking Andy Burnham as the UK's most popular politician. He was an MP until 2016 when he left to become Mayor of Greater Manchester. Dubbed King of the North for standing up for workers, he's now returned to national politics after winning the by-election last week and says he'll challenge for Labour leadership. His most likely rival, Wes Streeting, says he's going to support Burnham too.
We could spend the summer splitting hairs on small differences, or we can pull together.
So Keir Starmer will stay on as a caretaker Prime Minister until a new one is chosen, with nominations to enter the leadership open until mid-July. With opinion divided over the change...
Andy Burnham will change Britain for the better.
It's still going to be Labour. We're still going to be f***ed.
While some remain hopeful.
I think that's what we've lost in this country, is this feeling that we're all one country and that there is this massive divide and such a polarised world. The ability to bring North and South, East and West together in this country and across the world, I think, is so important.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there. And yeah, we've had a lot of comments coming through about this big development in UK politics, what it's going to mean for the UK. A lot of people noticing some similarities between stuff that's happening in the UK, maybe something that's happening in Australia as well. drawing some comparisons between Keir Starmer and our own Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and wondering whether there are lessons for other Western leaders. Look, let's get a bit further into this story now with someone who's been covering this closely. And Ava Santina is the politics editor at Politics Joe, which is an independent British political news outlet, a podcast. It's on socials. Go check them out. Ava, it's so good to have you on. How are you feeling after a massive day?
Good morning. Good afternoon for you guys, I suppose. What time even is it there? I mean, here we've just woken up. We've got the hottest summer of our lives over here, which is probably nothing for you guys. But here it's 40 degrees Celsius and no one can cope. Everyone's gone a bit mad. We've lost a prime minister, and now all of our MPs are fighting about who's going to be the next one.
Yeah, it's a bit wild, this whole situation. I mean, a lot of people here in Australia are asking right now, how does Keir Starmer go from a landslide win to being pushed out in just a couple of years?
Well, I mean, to understand that, you have to think about where British politics has been for the last decade. And, you know, we have had a succession of quick-fire prime ministers. You know, we haven't really had anyone in post in 10 Downing Street for more than a couple of years, really. So actually, Keir Starmer's not done too bad if you compare him to the last prime minister, which was Liz Truss. And that was a cataclysmic mere couple of weeks, actually. But, you know, when he was elected, he was brought in on a promise that he was going to keep taxes low, that he was going to increase spending, that there were going to be some quite dramatic changes to the cost of living crisis that we've seen over here. You know, people have really been tightening their belts for the last few years. And it's been rather dire for a number of people, but nothing has changed for a good couple of years. And so people are just really crying out for something different. And this Andy Burnham, who's now been elected just a couple of days ago, it really does feel like last ditch saloon. This is make or break. If people can't feel change with him, then I don't really know what we're going to do as a country.
Yeah, I want to ask you about Andy Burnham in a bit, because I know that you know him, you've interviewed him before, but in terms of the reaction in the UK, you're speaking with a lot of people, you're speaking to a lot of young people as well. What are they telling you? Like, are there many people who think that Keir Starmer has been hard done by here?
There's certainly a bit of buyer's remorse, I think. When Keir Starmer yesterday was standing outside 10 Downing Street and he seemed rather emotional, and we'd never seen him like that before. You know, he almost shed a tear. And I think a lot of people sort of sat back and thought, oh, hang on a minute. Have we made the right decision here by pushing him out? But, you know, look, if you are under 35 in this country, you have had a bit of a, you know, you haven't had the best end of the stick for the last decade or so. Housing is extraordinarily expensive in our cities. We've got an increasing number of under 35s who are still living with their parents. A number of young people, if they've got a good graduate job, they're paying 51% tax because of how high the student loan repayments are over here. You know, you've got a bit of a hard deal. And so I think they're looking towards someone like Andy Burnham and away from Keir Starmer in a bid to hopefully make their lives a little easier.
A lot of people in Australia right now, Ava, who are nodding their heads going, same, same, very similar issues that seem to be impacting young people in the UK and in Australia. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Ava Santina, who's the politics editor at Politics Joe. We're talking about all of this stuff going down in the UK over the past 24 hours. So Keir Starmer announcing that he's stepping aside. Let's talk about Andy Burnham, Ava, because I've seen his rise being described as potentially the most perfect heist in political history. What is his style like? Like, what can you tell us about Andy Burnham as someone who knows him?
Well, I can tell you about Andy Burnham right now, but I can't tell you what Andy Burnham is going to be like in a few weeks. And the reason I say that is that he is rather changeable in his politics. So he has been several different iterations over the past couple of decades. So he was originally someone who came up through Tony Blair. He worked in that government. He was then, a messiah of Gordon Brown, a prophet, sorry, of Gordon Brown, who was the subsequent prime minister. And then for the last few years, he's been the mayor of Manchester, which is England's second city after London. And it has experienced rapid growth, over the last couple of years. It's he's really implemented a system of, well, huge investment. He's got a thing called the Good Growth Fund, which is sort of like the city's own banking, or the city's own coffers, which is actually rather unusual for the UK. It's got a huge investment pool for businesses. It's also got nationalised buses, which is something that a lot of people are hoping are going to be replicated across the country. But the way that Andrew Bynum presents himself is a lot more normal than, say, someone like Keir Starmer. He seems to be someone who heads down to the football. He's someone that you could sit down and have a pint with. He seems to be just a lot less, gosh, it's going to sound like really sort of pejorative on Keir Starmer, but Keir Starmer always came across as rather upper middle class. Andy Burnham feels more working class and normal. Whether that is actually true or not doesn't really seem to matter, because it's all in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? It's all the perception that matters.
So does the Labour Party in the UK believe that Andy Burnham has what it takes to confront this real surge that you're seeing in the Reform Party, this populist party?
Well, I mean, if you look at what just happened in that by-election that elected Andy Burnham a couple of days ago, you know, the Reform vote collapsed. Andy Burnham won with over 50% of the vote. He won, you know, tens of thousands of votes, which is really surprising for a by-election. Normally, voters don't turn up, don't really turn up for the ballot box for those. So the argument there is actually people are choosing progressive politics over that more right-wing, some would argue far-right politicking. People are choosing this. They'd rather have potentially higher taxation and better public services than they would have an anti-immigration rhetoric.
I mean, Ava, I don't expect you to know a whole heap about Australian politics, but there are already comparisons that are being drawn between Sir Keir Starmer and our own Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. Like, they both won historic majorities in recent years. They've both been criticised for a lack of political courage. They've both faced these threats from the rise of the far-right populist parties. Do you think there is a lesson here for other Western leaders?
Well, certainly. I mean, we've seen, I mean, all across Europe, massively in the United States, there has been a huge tack to the far, you know, to the right. A lot of people think, you know, a lot of leaders are thinking that actually the only way to tackle that, rather than implementing, say, better tax policies or to bring in more progressive politics or to increase defence spending, that actually they can win it with rhetoric and they can win it with narrative. And you're seeing across Europe that that's not working. I mean, if you look over at Germany, you've just seen the decline of the AfD party, which is their right-wing party. You've also seen in France a slight tacked more now to the central ground. So, you know, that's possibly a lesson that Australia can learn. But look, you know, we are really living in a world where America is dominating most of our politics. You know, we've got the Strait of Hormuz. Is that open this morning? Is that closed? We never know. We find out every day, don't we? We just see it in our oil prices. You know, it's just America's game and we're sort of living the repercussions. But I think, you know, as a reaction, if you do head more left-wing, as Andy Burnham has done, I think it can prove to you you can win elections.
Oh, well, we've got so many questions coming in from Australians. We don't have time to get to them. People want to know about Hot Podium Guy, which is another thing that's really popped off over the past couple of days. Ava Santina from Politics Joe, really appreciate you making the time to chat with us in Australia.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Hack. So today, a development and one the government was hopeful of getting is that it will be able to pass its tax changes.
On Triple J.
Yeah, after copping criticism from all sides, the federal government has done a deal to pass those budget changes it announced 6 weeks ago. An agreement with the Greens is going to lock in a winding back of negative gearing and capital gains tax concessions that benefit investors. Let's get the rundown now. From Parliament House, here's Evelyn Manfield.
Our tax reforms will make it easier for Australians to buy their first home.
The Prime Minister is tax maxing with the Greens.
The government could have actually tackled the housing crisis, but they didn't have the guts to do that.
Labor is pulling up the ladder on opportunity.
6 weeks after announcing major tax changes in the federal budget, the government has finally secured the support in Parliament to make them a reality, albeit with a few changes.
This is a really important day for tax reform in this country.
The government won over the Greens, who'll back the crackdown on negative gearing and the capital gains tax discount. But even they're not all that happy.
This package is a small step in the right direction.
That's Larissa Waters, the leader of the Greens.
They could have actually gotten rid of those unfair tax perks for the very wealthy that's made it so hard for everyone else to have a home.
So back on Budget Day, despite previously ruling it out, the government decided to limit negative gearing and the current capital gains tax discount to new builds. And it's been controversial for a bunch of reasons. The government decided to keep the current arrangements for people who already have investment properties. And some people think that's unfair. There's also a lot of anger that the new CGT discount applies to other assets like businesses and shares.
Investors are going to pay more. Savers are going to pay more. Small businesses are going to pay more.
That's opposition leader Angus Taylor.
That is an assault on aspiration in this country. That is an assault on ambition.
According to the budget documents, these changes over 10 years will help 75,000 Australians buy their first home. They'll also see rents rise by roughly $2 a week. And house prices, well, they're forecast to still go up too, just at a slower rate than the big growth we've been seeing. Although there is some evidence already that house values are falling in some markets, like Melbourne and Sydney. I went to the Prime Minister's press conference today to ask him about house prices.
Do you know the median price of a unit in your own electorate, Prime Minister, and prices that young people are facing trying to buy a house in, say, Marrickville?
What I know is that prices in Marrickville have increased substantially. Right throughout the whole country, that has occurred. What we are doing here is I talked to someone last weekend who was able to be successful at an auction that previously they'd almost given up on. That's a fantastic thing.
Now, despite not being massive fans, the Greens are backing the changes. It's partly because they've done a deal with the government to delay their massive NDIS changes by getting a longer inquiry into the consequences of the planned overhaul. Here's the Greens disability spokesman, Jordan Stilljohn.
We will be voting against this bill. It is a piece of legislation which seeks to raise money from those in our community that are struggling the most.
But the Minister for the NDIS, Mark Butler, says the spiralling cost of the scheme needs to be controlled.
This is necessary reform, it's hard reform, but I'm not going to sugarcoat the fact that big change needs to happen to the NDIS.
Hack Triple J.
Evelyn Manfield reporting there from Canberra. And Hack has asked the Prime Minister to come on for an interview this week. He's not been available. If you do want to see Ev asking Anthony Albanese about property prices, you heard a bit of it there, but if you want to see more of that kind of question and answer, go check out Hack's Instagram and TikTok. You'll be able to see it all there. And there's so many comments on that reel and TikTok. Someone saying, I sense the next election outcome is going to be based on who can provide affordable housing that doesn't create lifetime debt. Another person saying, he's basically saying we're giving young people a fair crack by being in a lifetime of debt with banks and suffering a huge financial loss when eventually the housing market crashes. Yeah, a lot of people got big thoughts about that one. Go check it out.
Hack.
Debt is not the problem. Our discomfort around it is.
On Triple J.
The hardest thing in life we've got to confront is death. Our own, the death of loved ones. But for something so important, many of us really don't talk about it much. There's a job out there, though, which aims to help people deal with the end of life. They're called death doulas, and they really have been growing in popularity in recent years. Scout Wallen's been looking into it.
If you haven't experienced death, I think that it's like a big question mark, and I think it's something that most young people don't think about or consider.
When Sarah's dad died a few years ago, it changed her perspective about death.
And I was with him when he died, and I found it to be like a really profound and quite beautiful experience, despite how hard it was.
The 28-year-old says she wanted to do something with this new outlook on death when she discovered the concept of a death doula.
I had already been looking for something where I could be like giving back and working in a space that felt like I was like contributing positively to other people's lives and experiences, and finding that being a death doula was like a career was really life-changing.
A death doula, also known as an end-of-life doula, is someone that helps people dying and their families navigate end-of-life. It's a non-medical role that supports people in emotional and practical ways, from planning funerals to creating a calm environment as someone takes their last breaths. Based in Los Angeles, Sarah posts online about her journey as a death doula.
So you may have heard of a birth doula, but have you heard of a death doula? Well, just like birth doulas help people come into this world, death doulas help people exit.
Sarah calls herself a baby doula. By that, she means she's still very early to the career.
I think part of like why I want to encourage people to think about it more, talk about it, is not to like dwell on this thing that could be considered negative or like scary, but just like, are there things in your life that if you put into this perspective of like, if I was gone tomorrow, would this decision be making me happy?
We've got just a basket I take and a couple of wraps that I put in those in case someone needs someone's chili, and it could be when someone's actually dying.
That's Annie Caulfield. She's got two kids in their 20s and has been working as a death doula in Brisbane for about 4 years.
Talking about death isn't scary. It's not going to bring it on. It's like talking about sex won't get you pregnant. Same thing. Talking about death won't make you die any sooner.
She says death doulas support both the person who is dying and their families.
You know, 100 years ago when death was in the home, you know, you would have people dying at home and people would be around it, kids would be around it. Now that doesn't really happen. So young people, you know, have probably never been up close to someone who is dying or seen a death.
Annie says social media and celebrities are helping to bring the practice of being a death doula to the mainstream.
With, you know, people like Nicole Kidman and Chloe Zhao, the director of Hamnet, announcing to the world that they were going to be death doulas or they were training to be death doulas. I think that's been great in so far as it's really brought it to the world.
In Australia, healthcare workers are regulated by a national code of conduct, which is legislated by each state and territory.
So there is a Cert 4 that came out a couple of years ago, and a skill set within that that you can do if you want to become a death doula. But a lot of it is about the passion behind it rather than the training itself.
Palliative Care Australia says the number of people practicing as end-of-life doulas is growing. They say that people have the right to engage these doulas, but want to remind families that they are not medical practitioners and can't dispense medicines or advice, but are there to provide support. Despite being at different points in their careers, both Annie and Sarah want young people to start talking about death sooner rather than later.
A lot of people wish they'd had conversations much earlier. I hear that a lot, that there's a, oh, I wish we'd done this, you know, years ago, or when I first was diagnosed.
I think it's something that gets put off to later on in life as like, it's not a worry right now when, you know, it really could happen at any moment. We're not guaranteed anything.
Hack on Triple J.
Scout Wallen reporting there, and we're hearing from you as well. Someone saying such important work. Another person saying every death doula I know is really specific about informing families that they are non-medical support. We are death escorts, if you like, and we complement and fill in the gaps. It's sacred work, and I feel really blessed to work in this space. Lovely, lovely comments coming through on death doulas, on talking about death. And I want to do a bit more of that now with Dr. Georgina Robinson, who's a social scientific researcher in death studies at the Uni of Melbourne. Dr. Robinson, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Can you see more people starting to rely on the support of death doulas in the years ahead? Do you think this is a trend that's only going to continue to grow?
Yeah, I mean, so I haven't had heaps of direct experience with death doulas myself, but I think the increase in the number, availability and awareness of them and the work that they do can only be a good thing. And, you know, seeing this in the news just highlights that, I think, really clearly. I mean, I'm a firm believer in the fact that people can be really open to talking about death, but they need the correct environment and tools to do so. And, you know, for someone like me, if I was speaking with my parents, for example, that would probably be best done over a beer with me as the quote-unquote expert in this area. But for most people, they probably don't have, like, a death expert as their daughter. And so that's where death doulas and death cafes and the like come in to really facilitate those conversations and guide people along. They're kind of like a midwife, as you would expect during pregnancy, but, you know, transitioning to the end of life rather than the start of life.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. And I'm really fascinated with your area of research. Like, studying death studies is interesting. I mean, do you feel like there is a lot of engagement from young people? Like, in your research, have you seen young Australians want to learn more about this kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there is kind of a conception of that we live in a society that is death denying, and that we don't like to talk about death at all. But I think we kind of live in a little bit of a paradox now where there is this absolute true engagement. We love to consume death through TV and the media, films and the like. But then death is sort of sequestered and privatized. So people go to hospital to die and then they go away and they're taken into a funeral home. And so death is kind of hidden. But actually, there is this openness, as I say, if there's a correct environment to speak about death. And here at the University of Melbourne and back at the University of Durham, where I was in England before I moved to Australia, I've taught on subjects about death with for second year and third year undergraduate students, and they're always radically oversubscribed. And I think it's really rather beautiful to see that these young people are electing to take these subjects within their broader undergraduate degrees and engage directly with death. They then go away and talk about it with their friends and families and, you know, open up conversations that I think would otherwise probably not be had over dinner tables. And so, yeah, there is that openness there for sure.
Do you think social media is playing a role in this? Because, I mean, death talk is a thing as well. And also people just sharing their experiences of end of life, whether it's with parents or grandparents or other loved ones, is that helping to, I don't know, shine a light on some of this stuff and the experience that people are going through?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as with any kind of social media, there's always going to be positives and negatives. But yeah, the likes of death talk or grief talk, as we've seen emerging, I think have been really positive spaces, especially for young people who are perhaps navigating their own loss. So they can resonate with, you know, others online and sort of shared community to talk about and reflect on their own personal, perhaps grief experiences. You know, there's grief influencers out there that could be quite therapeutic. But I am also slightly concerned that sometimes algorithms might drive someone into a negative state with that too. But I think, you know, the more open we can be and the more conversations we can facilitate about death, the better, really.
Yeah, I guess it's a fine line, isn't it? People can really be drawn down into something that makes them a bit sad and it's hard to get out of. But we've got a lot of messages coming through on this. Someone says, I'm starting to see more death doulas in residential aged care, and it's definitely supporting families. They're more informed and they feel more relaxed. We've got Phoebe on our text line saying, my grandparents are a massive part of my life and I have really open conversations with them about death and how we plan to take care of them when they start to decline. It is scary and it's sad, but it's really, really important. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Dr. Georgina Robinson from the University of Melbourne, and we're talking about death, which maybe is not something that sounds like something you might want to talk about generally, but it's not a sad story, because we're talking about why death doulas are becoming more popular and why we need to be having more of these discussions. Dr. Robinson, some parts of society do really struggle with talking about death more than others. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think, to be honest, aside from the stigma surrounding death, I mean, death is difficult. You know, even for someone like me, my parents and friends jokingly call me Dr. Death. They think it's rather weird that as a, you know, somewhere in their late 20s that I research death for a living. But even in this context, you know, death is an emotionally loaded subject. And so to open up that can of worms and have these conversations is always going to be difficult. But what I would say to anyone who is thinking about perhaps their own funeral wishes or speaking with parents and grandparents and the like, to have those conversations will only be a benefit to you and to your, you know, to your family and your friends. So, you know, take a breath, find a moment and a correct space where you can do that. And just take it steady, you know, maybe start with like, what song would you want if, you know, at your funeral? And then you can maybe just start creating a playlist and go from there. And then maybe you might be like, well, burial or cremation, or would you like some new option like alkaline hydrolysis, for example?
Yeah.
You know,
that is really interesting stuff. And it's actually that innovation that I want to be talking more about. We might have to do another hack story on that and get you on again, Dr. Robinson, to talk about some of these interesting things we're seeing and how we're dealing with death and the logistics around burial, that kind of thing. But look, it's been a pleasure speaking with you this afternoon, Georgina Robinson from the University of Melbourne. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
And we've got a lot of messages coming through, not just on this, but also the UK politics stuff that we were talking about earlier. lot of people who have big thoughts on Keir Starmer deciding to pack it in and go. Someone's saying it's rearranging the deck chairs on a sinking ship. Wouldn't really work here either, is Rob's point of view. Another person says it feels like politicians only start to sound genuine when they speak from the heart right after quitting or after retirement, which is interesting. All right, that is all we've got time for on my hack for now.